This is the Average Guy Network, and you have found Home Gadget Geek, show number 631, with Christian Johnson, recorded on December 5th, 2024. Here on Home Gadget Geeks, we cover all the favorites, tech gadgets that find their way into your home, news reviews, product updates, and conversation, all for the average tech guy. I'm your host, Jim Carlson, broadcasting live from the AverageGuy.tv studios here in a chilly Bellevue, Nebraska. Of course, we'll post a show, and I'll get them from Christian with some world-class show notes out at TheAverageGuy.tv. If you haven't been out to check out the show notes in a while, I say this to you every week, check them out. We've actually... AI is kind of helping me with those show notes, and they're doing some good stuff, so you can check them out. Head out there. For this show, theaverageguy.tv/HGG631 will get you there and take you right to it. Big thanks to our Patreon subscribers who are faithful every single month. I just got paid for that, and I appreciate you guys doing that. We have a $5 plan that's available for you. Head up to theaverageguy.tv/Patreon 1 month or as many as you want. Many of you just stick with it. Appreciate you guys doing that. Thanks for supporting me on Patreon. And then, of course, if you want to use it, it's that time of year. Christian, are you done with your Christmas shopping?
No, I'm usually always a late bloomer on the Christmas shopping. So I will say I have a good number of the ideas prepared slightly ahead of schedule for where I normally am this time of year. But I pull the trigger pretty late in the game usually. So
yeah, but you get it done, right? As you're doing it, just go out to theaverageguy.tv. There's a little on the upper right hand corner, right near the Maple Grove part, right above the Maple Grove Partners plans. Which by the way, still $10, Christian. How do you do this? Everything else is more expensive.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, inflation's going to follow you everywhere else, so you can have a nice reprieve by buying a plan at Maple Grove. We'll try not to.
You can do that.
Yep. Yeah.
I appreciate that. Right above that is a statement in red. It says, as an Amazon associate, I earn from qualifying purchasers. They click on that. It just takes Amazon. Nothing else you need to do. Good for the program. Good for the network. Good for the podcast. So you can do that as well, and easy to do before you go shopping, before you get it done. Tony is also, or John says, John Biggs says, usually end up wrapping gifts on Christmas Eve, which I'm kind of there too. I'm done. I don't have to do much. Sarah does most of it, but it's all done, but I won't wrap them till Christmas Eve. You are right. Big thanks to Sammy who joined us last week. Kind of become the tradition to be on the show on that Friday after Thanksgiving. If you haven't listened to that, you can go out and do it. And then we're celebrating anniversaries tonight, but maybe the first one I'm going to talk about, it was a year ago today. I had prostate surgery and 70% of my prostate was removed. And all is well. So a year later, awesome. Things are good. Yeah. That's yeah. Really and great. I shouldn't say prostate was removed because they just removed 70% of it. So there's still 30% there doing its job. Things are working better than they ever have, which is pretty awesome. Modern medicine's pretty great. Tony, thank you for your work that you do in medicine. It's pretty great. You were mentioning Gary's looking good too, right? I mean, Gary, who had been on the show way back in the day, provided guest hosting. He's doing all too modern medicine. Good. It's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed.
It's going to be interesting to see what modern medicine's doing in like 2050. We're going to be like, oh, that's cool. I saw that in a movie somewhere.
it could be really interesting.
Yeah,
what's coming up. Well, speaking of interesting, we're celebrating 14 years. We're not going to spend a ton of time. We're not going to look back for too long, but I asked you before the show started, do you ever think 14 years ago we would be here today?
No.
You know, on that first show, thinking about that, as you've been podcasting with me the whole time, anything you've learned about yourself or anything you'd pull from those 14 years of podcasting that just kind of stand out to you?
Probably a few things. One is learning how to communicate to different audiences. I think podcasting teaches you that in a unique way, because folks get attracted to different shows and different discussion. There's some things that work really well for some folks and some things that don't. And if you don't love what you're doing or talking about, it won't come through on the podcast. So show won't be for everyone. That's okay. Be really passionate about what you do talk about, and people who are also passionate about that or want to learn about that will naturally gravitate towards it. And you know, the community aspect to me is still kind of really remarkable. I mean, 14 years ago, podcasts, I wouldn't say were common, you know, it wasn't like Joe Rogan had taken the world by storm or anything. No. So like the concept of podcast saturation, I don't think was really out there. I know it was kind of a hot buzzy thing probably when we started. It wasn't like it was, you know, the first podcast, but you know, compared to where we are 14 years later, podcasting is extremely commonplace, extremely saturated. There's a lot of content to listen to. It's almost like how much, you know, content there is to stream now. So there's something out there for everyone. So if you're gonna, you know, get on the internet and create original content, you may as well do it in things that you generally love talking about and doing. So I think that's important. Especially when you think about, you know, 631 episodes and counting. It's got to be stuff that you know brings joy and you have fun talking about.
Yeah. Well, for me, it's an opportunity to connect with you or whoever's on the show. Right. I've never seen this as the listeners, don't take this the wrong way. I've never seen it about the listeners. It's always been about us getting together, having a conversation. Absolutely. And the benefit we recorded it and we push it out. And if folks want to listen in, they can couple hundred, you know, but some weeks in the 200 and 300, some weeks in the 500 and 600s. That number just does not change that much, Christian, which is crazy. Yeah. That they just every week just show people show up, and it's great community. I obviously, you know, I've gone through a couple iterations of like, should I stop? And I keep coming back to, nah, why should I? This works out pretty well. And we're having a good time, and it morphs and changes. You know, we go back to the early days of Cyber Frontiers, and we did that for a while, and then said, nah, you know what? We got to just roll that into Home Gadget Geeks and be good with it. Yeah. And we did. And successfully, those are still out there if you want to go listen to them. But anyways, I appreciate for you listening and joining us live. Appreciate you guys for the 14 years we've been doing this, and on a crazy Thursday evening in December, 14 years ago, we cranked out the very first one of these, and I go back and listen to it and go, oof, got some work to do. And we got most of that work done, I think, in a lot of ways. So some good stuff. So I think thanks to all the folks who, you know, were a part of that. And I'd start naming names, but I would forget people. So appreciate everybody. And for you listening, appreciate you guys as well. Speaking of appreciating, Christian, you announced last time you were on, you are a dad to be. How's that going? Everything good so far? Everything?
Yeah, it's going awesome. We're on week 24. And
I should probably ask that in pre-show just to make sure I didn't step in it. Yeah.
So everything's going well. We're
good. Good.
We're enjoying it. So
I asked the audience to submit some dad jokes since you're going to be
awesome. A dad.
Right. And Brian was kind enough to give us some dad jokes. We have about a minute of those. So don't fast forward through them. Brian took his time on this. Christian, take some notes. You're going to want these. And Brian, thanks for sending them in. Here they are.
Brian, and just wanted to call in and give some dad jokes for Christian. First, I've got some tech-based ones. Why did the computer go to the doctor? Because it had a virus. Why did the server go broke? Because it lost all its cash.
Yep.
Why was the computer cold? Because it left its windows open. Why did the computer show up late to work? It had a hard drive. How many programmers does it take to change a light bulb? None. That's a hardware problem.
Yeah, that's pretty good. We got a few more here. We'll roll through.
And now I have some tech-based dad jokes specifically for a dad-to-be. What do you call a baby computer? A microchip.
Mm-hmm.
How do tech-savvy dads know they're ready for fatherhood? They've installed all the updates. What did the computer say to the dad-to-be? Prepare for a major upgrade. How does a techie dad calm a crying baby? By resetting their sleep mode.
Well, there you go.
And why do techie dads love coffee? Baby needs a fully charged dad. Congratulations, wow. Christian.
Very awesome.
Brian, thanks for sending those in. Appreciate that. And if you want to do some dad jokes after the fact, you can head over to theaverageguy.tv. There's a microphone in the bottom right-hand corner, or you can just sit down, record them, send them to me, and we'll play those. But what do you think, Christian?
Awesome. I really appreciate that, Brian. There's some pretty quality ones in there. I'm going to have to add to my personal journal of jokes. So
yes. Yeah. Those, Dan said, ha, those are some quality dad jokes. So you're coming up on it. I'm excited for you. It's a whole new thing. And you think, you know, with the first one, I'll tell you this and you won't believe me, but with the first one, you think you got it all together, and you probably will, just to be honest with you. One is pretty manageable. It's the second one that really gets you, right? You're thinking, oh man, I'm the best parent in the world. Like, I have done everything right with this first kid. Well, you've squeezed them really hard. That's why they're all good kids and responsible, because all you've done is give them your attention. They've gotten everything from you. You've done everything right. That second one comes along and just crushes everything you think you know about parenting. So if you decide to stop at one, it's maybe not a bad idea. If you move on to two, may the force be with you, I guess is what I have to say. And three's right out. Like three, then you've created a middle child.
And then you got to balance it back out with the fourth child, right?
Oh, yeah. No, well, I'm not going to give you advice on that one, but we're excited for you, and we'll keep up to date with you as all these things progress going forward. Glad everything's going well and everything's healthy so far. So that is good. You've got some challenges ahead, but all of them, it's super great to be a dad. It is just super. It's the best privilege in the world. So you're getting set up for something very, very cool. Okay. It's not very cool. And I had no idea this had hit, but you had thrown a link in there, a link in the notes to talk about. So we're going to make a pretty drastic shift. The FBI in the last couple of days has said, hey, Android users, or hey, iPhone users, don't send text messages to Android people. There may be some, okay, is it that bad? I mean, how do I know? Talk a little bit about what you know. Where are we at and why is this happening and is it real?
Yeah, so I felt I had to talk about it because at first I thought, man, everyone must have seen this article and be talking about it. And then I was talking to some coworkers about it and they were like, I haven't seen the article or really, or, you know, they did that. And so, you know, both the FBI and CISA are jointly urging the American people to use secure messaging apps. So they're, you know, pushing for, you know, encryption's your friend, go use something that has encryption in it. And the specific kind of text messaging that they're talking about here would be anything that's RCS/SMS, right? So if you're iPhone to iPhone, that's going over Apple's encrypted messaging network. So that's not what we're talking about here because those are encrypted by default, but, kind of your true SMS or things that are RCS, or exchanging between that protocol rather. So SMS or unencrypted RCS, those are in the clear. Both the FBI and CISA have been tracking this hacking campaign called Salt Typhoon, which is what Microsoft labeled this hacking. And it's considered one of the largest compromises in U.S. history, which I feel like I get to say on this podcast once a year. yeah, unfortunately. Oh, no. And, you know, the things that the hackers got access to was, you know, everything from call records, live phone calls, the metadata associated with your phone records. And they're even talking about classified court orders being caught up into this, according to an NBC News report, right? So the ZDNet article that'll be in the show notes that was written by Lance Whitney, who's a contributor over at ZDNet, does a pretty good job giving a high-level characterization of what that communication was from the FBI and CISA. And I just think it's really interesting because it's not every day that you have a government agency kind of urging people to think about what they're doing with their cell phone in this kind of way. Like, you know, a lot of focus on phone call and good hygiene and this and that, but text messaging apps, I've just never seen that come out as guidance of any kind, officially or unofficially. So that's cool. And CISA, believe it or not, linked at the bottom of that article, is giving this online guide called How to Communicate Securely on Your Mobile Device. So, you know, pretty wild. The first recommendation: to prevent threat actors from accessing your communications, you should, one, use a properly vetted secure messaging app with end-to-end encryption and voice over internet protocol functionality for text messages and voice calls, and to place sensitive information in an encrypted file attachment when you send emails. That's pretty interesting. And so the push in the article has kind of three pillars: the end-to-end encryption, the voice over IP, and the multi-factor authentication is kind of those three pillars for secure communications. And obviously some of that is related to your mobile device and texting. Some of that is related more towards how you use email, et cetera. But I just thought, you know, that was pretty novel news that made its way around this week. And I was kind of surprised that, you know, a lot of people who are very tech oriented in my life were like, you know,
that's the first time I heard it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You dropped it. Dan has asked, okay, so if I'm getting 2FA notifications through text, are those in the clear?
Yeah. I mean, all of those messages are often, so I have an iPhone, right? So like if I go and I look at some of my challenge pins I get, right? Some of them do show up as coming from the Apple network, but a lot of them are just going to be plain SMS/RCS. So I would not assume that your 2FA text messages are coming over a protocol other than SMS. And so that really means that you're ideally, if you can use the authenticator apps or something that is not a text message based MFA, that is always the most recommended solution. And that's not only because of, you know, the concerns around these texts being in the clear or being compromised, but also prior to that, there's been a lot of phishing where people get their SIM cards, you know, popped or cloned, or they, you know, they basically clone your SIM card and get your account turned over to their control. And then all of a sudden all your text messages are going to a phone that you don't own. So that's a worse form of it. And they can't do that if it's an authenticator app or some type of textile thing. So yeah, the texted codes, I would say, are the least secure type of 2FA that is out there. And so one of the features I changed to in the last couple years with my adoption of Bitwarden for my password vault is that has a built-in 2FA generator and manager. So I can associate my MFA codes with particular logins. So I don't need to have a hardware-based token, but I don't need to rely on something that's SMS, and I don't need to carry an app around. And it can also autofill those codes when it generates, right? So if I do a web fill, it auto web fills the code. I don't even have to type it in. So I'll fill my username, password, and my MFA code. And with Bitwarden, I have it on my iPhone. I have it on my browser. I have it on my iPad. So it makes it super painless to do MFA securely. And a lot of websites now are supporting that type of MFA. I also have the Duo mobile app, which is it's a free app. You can go download, you can go use it. And then if you're really nerdy, Google has these kits. I haven't looked at it in a while, but they have the Google Advanced Protection Program. And with that will come these hardware-based keys. And they actually give you two versions of it. I don't remember where my other one is hiding, but one is like a Bluetooth near-field device, and I don't really like it. And the other one is a hardware key. And so that's, if you want to go truly to the hardware based, MFA, I recommend something like that or a YubiKey. Most people probably aren't going to want to do that, especially like if you're on your cell phone and you're trying to log into something, it's probably a little bit annoying. But you know, that's kind of the rising scale of gradient from least secure MFA options to most secure that I think are pretty accessible to the average guy at this point.
Mm. Jeez. So, oh my gosh, as I think about this, I'm like, oh crap. I just, you know, I've been spending all this time. I'm still trying to leave LastPass and get everything over on Bitwarden. I got about halfway there. There's a lot of stuff, right? Yeah. Got about halfway there, and then, you know, life got in the way. It's still working on it. Do I need to, so now with something like this, do I need to think about, okay, if I am getting 2FA passwords, I need to think in the moment, do I need to go change this at the place that's giving this to me? And think about how do I get it? Are there some things I can check? Is there a way for me to force this between? I mean, certainly for these providers, I think about, you know, maybe bank providers or whatever, they got to be thinking, hey, we're providing these 2FA codes through text. Mm-hmm. Is there some things they could be doing to do this more encrypted? I don't know. What are your thoughts?
I mean, so like, for example, if you know, Capital One's a pretty large bank, a lot of these types of banks now are offering MFA that has nothing to do with sending a text message. I think a lot of the smaller regional banks do SMS text messaging because they know it's something that the vast majority of their clients are going to have the ability to enroll in. But a lot of the banks are looking or have already implemented the other types of MFA. So I think it's the size of the bank and how much of a tech-focused culture that they have. But most of your bigger banks have already kind of implemented that. Now, of course, they still give you the option of doing it the less secure way. And there's not a lot of consumer advocacy. So it's not like the bank is going to explain to you why that's a less secure form of MFA. Maybe they should. Like, maybe they should say, hey, you know, you're enrolled in this as your form of 2FA, but, you know, here are some other options we recommend you explore. Maybe that would be a good thing to do, especially given that it's a bank account. But I don't see that very often. Usually you have to kind of dig and look for it in some instances.
In that article, again, we'll post the ZDNet article in the show notes, but it says, of course, you can turn to third-party messaging software such as WhatsApp, Signal, Telegram. Does Discord fall into that? Are they encrypted? Do you know?
Discord, I wouldn't consider to be an end-to-end encryption platform. Okay. So it's a super popular one. I use it all the time. It's a great community platform.
We have a family chat that way.
Yeah, but they don't. So they have a newer feature that came out this year. It was actually in end of Q3, where they came out with a feature for the audio and video in Discord to become end-to-end encrypted. But the text, both in a group channel and a private message, is not encrypted.
WhatsApp, of course, I think, and this is a weird one. Everybody else in the world uses WhatsApp.
Yeah.
Nobody uses it in the US. Like, it's just it's crazy how it's just there's been very little adoption of it. And in outside of the US, they use it for everything. You know, they're like, hey, what's your WhatsApp? And I'm like, oh, I don't have a WhatsApp. And like, how? They look at me like, how is that even possible?
I think some of it is also the phone too, because I think with WhatsApp, it's easier to make calls with numbers that are recognized by your contacts. And I don't know, I'm a WhatsApp user, so I'm completely uneducated, take nothing for granted with me in WhatsApp. But, you know, Signal is consistently rated the de facto most secure option. It's what PC Magazine rates as its best choice. Obviously, WhatsApp is up there as well. And then you kind of have this next tier with Telegram and Session and some of these other pieces. But I mean, Signal has a lot of easy integration with your contacts. It's still end-to-end secure. It supports things like disappearing messages. It makes it super easy to already know who the other Signal users are based on who's in your contacts. So it's not like you have to figure out who's there and what's going on. And so from a privacy perspective, I think it's definitely the way to go. Prior to being a Signal user, before it really became a popular thing, a platform we used to use in college was called Keybase, which is still out there. It's at keybase.io.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And they are maybe arguably one of the earlier end-to-end encryption clients. And I don't hear them get talked about as much these days. So I don't know what their deal is and how big their user base is. But we were Keybase users for quite some time. And
yeah,
simple client. Yeah. It got the job done. So
Ken and I were doing Chia, you know, mining, hard drive mining, crypto stuff. And their community was Keybase oriented. And it drove people crazy. Mm-hmm. And they were like, nope, this is a secure platform. This is where we're going to stay. We're not going to. And eventually they gave in and they're on Discord now. And, you know, they kind of, I'm sure they have a WhatsApp there. Kevin Schoonover says, hey, buddy, my family uses WhatsApp for video calls. And
well, yeah, Kevin on here to explain it to us because
it's the weirdest thing. It's no different in a lot of ways than Facebook, right?
Yeah,
from an app standpoint. It's crazy to me how there's been so little adoption of it in the United States. You talk to people and like, you know, again, with all the international work that I do, they'll be like, I'll say, hey, can you send me a message? And they're like, well, what's your WhatsApp? I'm like, I don't have a WhatsApp. Nobody uses it here, you know, in the US. So it is one of those. It is, and even Facebook Messenger has made an attempt to, you have to sign up for some things and do some things. But Messenger has made an attempt at end-to-end encryption. I don't know if it may be encrypted. I don't know how well it works from a user standpoint. I get all kinds of, sometimes I get double messages and I get, yeah, it's a weird thing. I don't, maybe I'm doing it wrong. From time to time, I have to put my PIN back in to make sure it's encrypted, you know, kind of thing. It's not, I don't know how robust it is. So Christian, I mean, okay. So do I need to, I probably need to start keeping track of, because I was early on those two FAs where I was getting, you know, security codes to the browser. I mean, to my text messaging. Should probably go through my text messaging history and start identifying those. Okay, here's the ones that are doing it. Go log back in at whatever, wherever that's at, and choose a new option. That's probably the smart thing to do, right?
Yeah, I think so. And with most of them, you can force like unenroll and re-enroll and or change the MFA, and that'll invalidate whatever the previous MFA was that you were on. So that's also an easy way to kind of to something you know is right.
Why do you do this to me? You always bring bad news.
To bring the bad news so that people can, you know, find the silver linings out of it, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
But try to keep you guys prepared.
Yeah. So it really just kind of tells us then, and I've never really paid attention on the SMS side of whether I'm getting messages from Android users or if it is iPhone user. Is there a way for me to know? How do you tell? I don't know how to do that.
So you're on iPhone?
Android? Yes, I'm an iPhone.
So on iPhone.
But Sarah's Android. So like all of our, although we use Facebook.
That's amazing. Most of the time. Yeah. So, yeah. I wouldn't recommend Facebook Messenger as a security system. So if you're an iPhone user and your text messages that you're receiving are blue, that's coming from another iPhone user. If they're green, it's coming from an Android phone. And in addition to that, if you look at the bottom of a thread with an Android user, which I'm looking for, you'll see if you open that thread up and you click to type in for a text message, in my case, it'll say text message, and a little bullet point, and then it'll say RCS. So that's telling you you're going over the iPhone to Android kind of messaging protocol. And I believe the if it's Android to Android via RCS, it's encrypted. But if it's iPhone to RCS, that's not going to be encrypted. And if it says SMS, it is also not encrypted. So pretty much, and then if it's an iPhone user you're talking to, it'll just say iMessage. So I don't remember what version of iPhone they introduced this, but it's a little subtlety right there that you'll see in the plain text before you start typing a message.
Oh, yikes. Oh, yikes. Okay. I don't have colors turned on, so that won't, I don't see that, but I do see in the message all the way at the bottom for you, it says iMessage, like for, for those, so for my buddy, Mike, it's going to be iMessage, but I do see I have a one going in between Sarah and our, my daughter-in-law, where it says text message dash RCS. That means they're Android, right? They're Android users.
Right.
And then I just got, so Sammy was in an auto accident and I was looking at the text messages that I'm getting from my insurance company and those say text message, SMS.
SMS, yeah.
So those are unsecure messages coming across. Chances are somebody else is reading them at this point is what.
Yeah.
And if you
look at those threads where you're getting 2FA codes from various websites, you'll 90% of the time it'll say SMS.
I think, let me see if I can find one. I may have to end this podcast.
Rethink his life. Yep.
And like, oh my God, is this, well, the good news is it looks like Apple notifications that are coming. I bought, you know, we're on, I'm on a new M4. So all those things, I would assume anything I'm getting notifications I'm getting from Apple are going to go through iMessage, right? Can I assume that? Any messages? I just bought a new Mac Mini M4. I get notification messages from Apple from their store on things being shipped and some of those kinds of things. I'm assuming those are probably iMessage, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Here's one. Okay. So yeah. So the Google, my Google authentication, the message is being sent from Google that's sending me the G and then the numbers, text message, SMS, right? Yikes, dude. This is fairly new, right? This is in the last 2 weeks, right? We've been talking.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, I think it was earlier this week, unless I also was late to the game here. There's another good question that was asked around if you have a group messaging thread going that is a mix between Android and iPhone, is, you know, what's the deal? And it drops down to the lowest denominator. So in this case, if it's a mix of Android and iPhone, it'll just start sending it as SMS. And so those will be considered unprotected communications.
Actually, here's one from Apple that is text message SMS coming from Apple.
Oh, fun. And I'm pushing over there on iMessage. Awesome. That is super awesome, Jim. That's great.
Your Apple account code, that's the, it leads with that, is, right? Fantastic. I was trying to see. Definitely. Yeah. This one is Home Depot. And it's definitely, now, okay, it's my Home Depot account. I don't store credit cards. One of the things I've never done is store credit cards on e-commerce sites. I just don't do it. But yikes.
Yeah.
God, Christian. This is bad.
I derailed the whole anniversary show on this one topic.
No, it's good. That's really good. I mean, every time you're on here, you give me a quarter's worth of work to do. How does this happen?
We build protocols and do things quickly, and we do it to get capability into people, and then we think about security later. I do genuinely believe in my heart that we're not as bad at it as we've historically been as a society, but SMS as a protocol has been around a long time, so you know, when you think about even, I don't think iPhone in its first version launched with, I don't remember what version, the iCloud and the iMessage network came out. I don't think the first iPhone had its own protocol. Let's see. iMessage was created in 2011 with the launch of iOS 5. So even Apple, which is a pretty forward-leaning company, you know, we had several releases of iPhone and iOS that just sent SMS. I mean, that was the protocol for sending text messages at the time. And so that's pretty cool. And then, you know, in the we're finally getting to the point, Joseph called out in the conversation, that Apple's also working to adopt an encryption for RCS. So that will help a little bit with newer Android phones talking to iPhones. We'll get the encryption turned on, which will be great. But yeah, SMS, it's just, you know, it's almost like, you know, TCP IPv4 type primitives just for phones instead of the internet. So
yeah. Yeah. Well, it's awkward that we've put in security protocol things into it that, let me say, I'm assuming this is happening because of the AT&T and Verizon hacks that have been going on, right? That have not really gotten very much. I mean, they've been talked about, but haven't been getting a lot of press. And I'm assuming, is this all tied together?
It is. I don't know why it hit people's news feeds differently. I felt like in some places when I went back and looked, it did get a lot of attention, and some other places it didn't. Obviously, the Salt Typhoon actor that Microsoft's been tracking has been happening for quite some time. So, you know, why we just get a news article about it this week, and maybe that's, you know, catching up to the level of discovery and understanding of what's going on. But, you know, don't know what else to say about that particular aspect of it. As a historical anecdote, I went and looked up at the history footnote on SMS here, which the protocol itself was developed in 1984, but it wasn't until December 3rd of 1992, so that's another, you know, milestone close to the day we're recording here, where the first SMS text message of Merry Christmas was sent between Neil Papworth and Richard Jarvis at Vodafone. So, yeah, SMS as a protocol is around kind of the same time a lot of the internet primitives were being built. So it's kind of, you know, it falls in that same story arc, which is pretty funny.
Well, crap. I got some work to do. I got some work to do. Tony says he's been deleting accounts, very long passwords, using services like Incogni and to become more secure. Thoughts on, he also asked thoughts on the new Apple password app, you know, as you think about.
I haven't used it, although I saw that it went on my phone. I think if you have not transitioned to using something like a Bitwarden or otherwise, and you're just looking for something simple, it's a secure implementation. I think it's great that we're finally getting more features like that just built into the OS platform, et cetera. Like, it's interesting to me. It would be cool to see something like Windows and iOS follow along with that, or Mac OS follow along with features like that. I guess technically both Mac OS and Windows have like a vault, but I don't know that it does a great job. Well,
browsers have vaults.
It's pretty bare bones. I mean, for me, like, I have no use case of using it just because Bitwarden works really well on the iPhone. I'm actually super happy with how that's been going. And it works great in the browser natively as well. So, and Bitwarden web app works really great when you're on the go and you're not on your own machine and you're using it somewhere else. So, personally, I'll stick with that, but I have no concerns about using the new password app that is being bundled with iOS. And I think it's great that they're doing it.
Wow, it's not what I thought you'd say. on that one. That's a first version. You know, it's there. I've been having trouble with Bitwarden on my iPhone in that it's asking me to authenticate every single time. So every single, not just every single password, but, or every single site.
So, but, yeah, I had similar experiences, and the thing that changed my life and made me no longer frustrated was I decided to cave and use Face ID. And ever since then, it's really a great experience with the Face ID. Because then, yeah, I'm kind of happy it asks every time, but it's like a half second for it to recognize the face, and then it autofills perfect. And so I was doing the same thing. I was constantly in Safari typing the password, and it was starting to drive me nuts. And I turned that feature on, and I'll never go back.
It's in Bitwarden itself, right?
Yeah. Okay. It's a setting within Bitwarden. But, you know, the other thing about, like, why do I trust the app that Apple's bundling. I mean, Apple has a really good track record with iOS security, so I'm not particularly concerned about, you know, it would be one thing if some new company or some new organization stood up a password manager overnight and was like, hey, use this thing. It's a new thing. Like, it's not a super vetted who it is, what it is the source code,
right,
et cetera, whereas with Apple, not super worried about it. Apple does cool stuff. Can I just say, if we're going to talk about privacy and security of phones that goes beyond texting, I recently changed and set up a iCloud family subscription plan through Verizon as part of their, like, new bundles where you can mix and match an ungodly number of different subscription services. And so I did that to change my bill recently because they were getting frustrated that I was on an old cell phone plan, and they try to kick people off old phone plans. It's fine. So I was like, okay, what the heck? Let's do it. And one of the best hidden gems of iCloud, because as you all know, I don't store things in iCloud because why trust a cloud, which is an oxymoron of my life. So I'm not discouraging you from that. A really cool built-in feature for iCloud Plus is private relay and hide my email. And so I cannot speak highly enough to how freaking cool those two features are and how easy and seamless Apple makes that to turn on and use. So with the private relay, you're getting a built-in VPN service to your phone. You don't have to set it up. You don't have to configure it. You're not paying anything outside of the iCloud subscription. It just works in Safari. Your IP address is fully anonymized. Your ability to be tracked is going to be significantly minimized online. That's fantastic. And then is like cherry on top, they offer a hide my email a feature for your every email account you have on your phone. So if you're signing up for a new service or you need to provide your email address in a web form and you don't know if that website's going to be hacked in 2 years or not, you can use the hide my email feature. It generates an on-the-fly iCloud anonymous address, basically a disposable email address that then will forward that message to your actual inbox so that you never have to worry about that disposable address getting compromised or leaked. And those disposable addresses can be set up as one time. And so really, really, really cool to see that level of just kind of built-in security coming with the subscription-based services from iCloud and having it go beyond, I guess it's considered an iCloud Plus feature, right? So that is really a highlight for me.
And $10 a month, right? For you do the 2 terabyte. They have a 200 gig plan for like $299, and then
I think I did the 200 gig plan because I don't store a lot in iCloud, right? I'm paying
$299.
If it's for the individual, yes. But I have all of the phones on our cell phone plan with Verizon get the subscription for one flat price. I think it's like, I think it's 16 a month for the family. It's either 10 or 16. I got to go look. But it's a good deal to get it through Verizon instead of getting it direct through Apple if you don't need the storage. If you do need the storage, then, you know, your mileage may vary. I think, it looks like I can upgrade the iCloud Plus in addition to the Apple One plan. So, okay, that's what it is. So I get the Apple One plan, which includes the iCloud Plus subscription. Apple One also includes the Apple Music, Apple TV Plus, and Apple Arcade. So that is $16 a month, and that gives the whole family up to 6 seats, I think. For $16 a month, 6 seats, you get that storage, you get all of the different Apple subscription services, and you get the iCloud Plus. So that is a deal. And then on top of your Apple One subscription, if you want to upgrade the storage, like, yeah, you could throw on another 200 gigs for $3. You could throw on another 2 terabytes for $10 a month, et cetera. But again, just the fact that in iCloud Plus, I mean, think about it. Like, how many times have we talked about different VPN service providers you can go buy? And they're going to charge you at least $3 a month for that VPN.
Yeah,
and if you just go get iCloud Plus as an individual user for $3 a month, you're getting all these built-in security features that I don't think people think about when they think about iCloud and Apple subscriptions. They just think about, oh, I need to store and back up my phone.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have the iCloud storage. I'm going to have to look at that. I just upped my VPN. I use Bitdefender. Use that for both. I have a Bitdefender box that I use for the house, which has worked really, really great. And then I get unlimited Bitdefender clients for Windows or Mac if I want to use. So it's unlimited in the space. And then they have a VPN, a premium VPN service now. And that's like, I think I paid $30, $40. That's the $3 a month, right, that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. To do, I always wait. They try to auto-renew it. I turn off the auto-renewal because it's $79, I think, full price.
Right.
And then they come back, hey, we'll give it to you for $40, you know, or whatever. Okay, I'll take that. That's kind of been my trick to get the right pricing. But yeah, this would be a way to kind of consolidate that down. I may have to take a look at that with all the subscription things we have now. It would be nice to consolidate some of those down. We got some good comments coming in. Let me talk about these in chat. Christian, you can respond to them. Joe says, I'm hesitant to use any messaging app that the FBI specifically recommends.
Well, you don't have to trust the FBI for it. You can go to any like Electronic Frontier Foundation or other firm that's equivalent to that, and they'll give you similar recommendations around Signal and other apps. So but I love the tinfoil hat thinking. It's awesome stuff.
It's not just not threat actors at times, right? I mean, we learned this couple years back with the NSA, right? So John says, I'm loving Bitwarden for long password generation. It does make it a lot easier. I keep my 2FA separate and use Google Authenticator for that. Any thoughts of, and actually I've got some in Google. I have some in LastPass still. I'm still using the LastPass Authenticator for some of them. And then I have some in the Microsoft side. Is there any, Christian, is there any value in, you know, you always talk about reducing the footprint. Is there any value in moving the stuff around or keeping it in different places so you don't have it all in one place?
Yeah, I mean, I think the advantage of that strategy is that technically if your master secret became known or your vault password became known, then it would defeat the value of the MFA, because then basically if they learn that vault password, then there's no separate step they have to get access to your MFA. So keeping them separate is probably a good security practice. I'm comfortable accepting the risk that I don't write down my master password anywhere, and it's a very long, you know, sequence. So it's not going to be something that Bobby Rainbow Table shows up and is successfully able to use. So I am comfortable with that risk, but I don't think it is a bad choice to want to separate those two out.
Two or three, you can put them. The hard part is of that. And because I have them on three different, you know, using three different, the Microsoft Authenticator is nice for work, right? Because it ties in with all the Office stuff that we're doing, and it's really easy to do. The Google one, it works well with the Google accounts and some of those other things. Not the Bitwarden. What would be the? Oh, I guess I'm still using a LastPass authenticator.
Yeah.
It's just another place, right? From that. So I don't know. It's the hard part is sometimes thinking, okay, where's it at? That's the hard part, right? Is knowing, okay, where did I store that thing? Now, you know, and you got to go into all three. Dan says out in chat, he says, hide my email is nice, but I've used a simple login for a long time and it's owned by Proton now, who is my primary email provider. So I tend to default to them. Tell me, what does hide my email do? Christian, explain that to me real quick.
It is similar to what the, so like the DuckDuckGo is one example. I don't know if they call it the same thing or not, but the equivalent feature in iCloud Plus, basically it's generating ephemeral temporary email addresses that you can use for any web form that you fill out or deal with. So, you know, a lot of times what happens is you'll create an account or you'll sign up for something or you'll check out at a store somewhere and it'll want your email address. And then later those emails get compromised and then you constantly get spammed and people start trying to send you phishing stuff. So the hide my email is basically a disposable one-time use email forwarder that will, you know, allow you to fill out that form with a uniquely generated address at this, in this case, like at iCloud.com is what it'll show up as. And then that email address will get forwarded straight to your actual inbox. So, you know, for the vast majority of those forms, it's not like you're responding or replying to those emails. A lot of them are no reply boxes anyway. So this is just a security measure to protect your email address from being, you know, part of the next data breach, and kind of giving you that peace of mind and privacy as well in transacting online.
I have a Yahoo account that I kind of use for that purpose. Like, I don't do anything with it except sign up for stuff with it. It's probably not the right way to do it. It's been compromised 9 times. Wow. Yeah. I mean, it's shown up on 9 different lists, right? And it does get spammed a ton. I don't do anything through it for the most part. It's kind of become my spam email. But it probably sounds like, and I've thought about this before, it's just so hard to do that. Because you don't, I've got things like my Amazon shopping account is actually tied to that Yahoo account. So I should probably go in there, move it, get it changed. And then probably shut those things down. But it's hard to do that stuff. Like, I mean, I've had that email address for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
You know, since the beginning. Tony asked a good question. And since we've talked a lot about LastPass, have you followed them at all? Have they done anything? I've seen some announcements come out. It seems like they're trying to harden some of the things they're doing. Thoughts?
I haven't looked too closely since we last talked about it. So I'm not up to date on the latest news of what they've been up to. I think they've had some ownership changes this year. I think Francisco Partners and Elliott Management are now owners in LastPass. So maybe they have changed some of the leadership structure as well, or at least the investors that are paying the bills for LastPass are, you know, help driving the company to keep making improvements. So, but outside of that, I have not tracked too closely how their journey is going.
I started the process of moving, you know, I would go in, move some things over, do some stuff, deleted some notes. I think that's what they call them in LastPass. Some notes, move some notes over. Got about halfway done and I ran out of steam. And, you know, changed the password, did a bunch of other things, took some stuff out that I thought, you know, changed all the banking ones, all the important ones to make sure they were changed and deleted off that system. But man, I like everything else. It's just hard to get all the way done, you know?
Yeah. And I found that I went kind of, cold turkey, I think, with RoboForm. I think I ended up not having a bad experience getting them imported, though. But the cleanup was, like you were saying, you know, you have to like do it in batches, and
yeah.
You only have so much attention span before you're like, okay, enough of that. So
opening things and closing and setting and long passwords and changing them and.
Yeah, so I just decided to try to get, you know, cut over first and then deal with, okay, this is how I'm going to, you know, go about.
Well, most of the passwords you can recover through password management, right? I'm always worried I'm going to delete something, especially in the crypto space. I did a bunch of crypto for a while. I'm afraid in some of those notes, I have passwords of things. You know, we hear stories about the early Bitcoin people. By the way, Bitcoin, $100,000, right?
Stuff. Yeah.
That's nuts. Maybe we'll talk about that in just a second. But the I'm always afraid, like, I'm going to delete a wallet, and then I'm going to, you know, 10 years from now, one of those things is going to go crazy, and I'm going to be like, oh, that was in my, oh, I deleted it. Right. And so I've been paranoid about not necessarily deleting those accounts. Let's just take LastPass as an example. If I actually go in and delete all of the passwords from the, you know, all the websites that are in there, is that the same thing as deleting the account, or is it different?
If you are individually deleting records within LastPass, then it's not like there is a restore function where you can undo the delete. Whereas a lot of times, if you're just like, I want to close my account, a lot of times the behavior in companies is different, where it's like, all right, like, we'll close the account, and then, like, we'll kind of put you in stasis for 30 days. And if you decide to change your mind or whatever, we can magically resurrect you. Now, I don't know if that's the case with LastPass and what their deletion policy is, but that would be the thing that I would look and index on, because if you're solely going through and deleting each one of those, I don't think you have to worry about, like, ghost copies running around. And also, technically, because LastPass enables or implements local-based encryption, it wouldn't even matter if there were ghost fragments of that around. Right. But in terms of, like, a data cleanup perspective, enumerating the individual records, I think, is, you know, it's not like the company is going to constantly be creating backup snapshots that reflect every single time you're taking a mutating action within your own kind of account. Mm-hmm. So
It would be smart just to end it, though. End it, close the account, have them delete. I'm assuming once you close the account with them, it deletes all that stuff permanently. You're right. They do have local. I mean, the encryption is done. They don't keep anything there, but
correct.
Some things. I have a long weekend of work to do. Ken is saying, any tips on blocking spam calls on iOS? This got out of hand during the elections. Like, I heard everybody complaining. I'm a T-Mobile customer, and supposedly they've got some software to help with this on the phone. It didn't. I got all kinds of, text messaging was out of control. Certainly. Thoughts on that?
So there is a feature. I'm less familiar with Android, only because it's been a while since I've had an Android phone, but for iOS, starting with iOS 13, they have a feature called Silence Unknown Callers. And you can find that in the settings tab. And what's interesting about that is it's not super often you will get phone calls from people that are not in your contacts. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, obviously, especially if you're taking a lot of business calls, et cetera. So that is one way if you just want, like, blanket coverage, so to speak. And then there are a lot of different apps on the App Store that help with filtering and screening calls. It's a hot commodity, and it integrates within iOS as well. So once you get one of those call screener apps, then in settings, in the phone settings, there's a section for call blocking and identification. And basically you can enable those apps, and it will allow the app to manage the screening of the caller ID. I've actually found that the built-in Apple doing it, where a lot of times it'll say, like, potential spam, has been incredibly accurate for mine. So that's been encouraging. And then also on top of your phone platform, usually you can enable spam screening with your provider as well. So, like, Verizon also has a spam screening service on top of that. And so a few different layers of control there. I don't know that any one of them is perfect per se, but I think it's gotten a lot better.
I get tons of them.
If anything.
I thought I'd enabled all those things to stop them, including what you were talking about of not in my connection, you know, not in my
contacts.
They still come through. I have to double check with it. But I don't answer any calls, just to be honest. Even if I know you, I'm like, you're going to voicemail. I just don't answer my phone. It's crazy how I've moved away from so excited to get a call to, I'm not really. I mean, I'll answer it if I know, if I know it's you, I'm going to answer the phone. But for the most part, they're going to voicemail. We kind of ruined, that's kind of been ruined for a lot of people, you know, picking up the phone and saying hello.
And obviously text message screening isn't really a thing, because it's like, here's the text, and rarely is it like it's not like there's a separate category for spam that it's doing by default. You can report junk, and I'm sure that helps the iMessage network filter out.
I don't know if it does. I've reported so many junk emails, you know, or text messages, you know, they just keep coming in. I wonder, will we get better at this, or will it just get worse?
I don't know that it gets better anytime soon. I don't know how much worse it can get. Maybe if you get to the point where everyone is on either iMessage or RCS, it's the SMS blast spam that is really the, I would say, the most frequent type of spam-based texting, right? So you're not really going to get spam if you're on iMessage unless someone has an iPhone that's on the Apple network. So that in of itself is a barrier, because it's not like someone is, you know, programming an iPhone to then send over. Like, that would get flagged very quickly. So in a way, the silver lining, I think, is that as SMS as a protocol gets deprecated,
will it? Do you think it will?
You know, it's like anything. It's like IPv6 is supposed to replace IPv4 as a layer 3 protocol, and we're still only at 50% adoption. And so we may get there at some point. So I don't think that they would ever turn the lights off on SMS at some point, but I think if RCS and iMessage start to represent the vast majority of phone-to-phone communications, then the algorithms and the filters get a little bit easier to write to be, you know, a bit more suspicious towards SMS based communication.
With this AT&T Verizon hack that happened a couple weeks ago, is there any way of going back? Is there any way of throwing those threat actors out? Are they in for good? Is this a new world we live in?
I mean, it's clear the data dump is pretty damaging. So, you know, it's not to say that they won't kick them out of the networks or secure the issues that led to the compromise and shore up these types of things. But in terms of the damage that they can do with the information they've already gotten and, you know, potential uncertainties that may exist with, like, did they get footholds in places that people haven't discovered yet? Like, probably open questions, which is probably why the advisory came out, right? So I think the damage is significant enough that it has permanence, even if we could say with certainty that they were kicked out as of time.now. I think the damage is substantial enough that I probably wouldn't have any assumption that my metadata or actual data over my cell phone provider is secure.
Do I need to worry about the past or just the future for messaging? In other words, stuff that, you know, was done 2 or 3 months ago, do you think that's as compromised?
I would assume that anything in the past is compromised, and okay. I would operate from, is there anything that I've sent or I've done or exchanged that is still relevant, right? So for example, if you're getting 2FA codes that expire in 15 minutes, okay, who cares if those are out? But if you, I don't know, texted a password to someone, don't ask me why you do that, but let's just say you did, that credential is going to be out there. So, you know, maybe, I don't know, your daughter asked for the password to the credit card website while she was away at college. Well, yeah, okay. So, and, you know, out of convenience, hey, can you help me reset the password? And, you know, texting was the easiest way to do it. So those would be the types of things I would be thinking about.
Yeah. Well, okay. So you just eased my fears a little bit. A lot of those passwords, those 6-digit codes, are time sensitive.
Yeah. They expire.
So they come, they expire, they're done.
Right.
Type deal. And even somebody who has access today, if I'm still getting those, somebody would have to act on those in that time period and have all the other pieces of information, right? To be able to.
Yes. 100%.
They would have to website, go in, know my username and know my password to even get that generated to begin with. So it's not, I was kind of thinking, oh, I'm dead. Like, okay, this is the end of the world. I think
cool. It's less bad than you thought then.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, yeah. I mean, it still comes down to being smart. I mean, all of a sudden, you know, the other day I sent Sarah a password for something and I'm trying to remember what it was for. And I'm like, did I send that over text? Like, was that, or, you know, or what did I, you know, how did I send that? I'm looking through it right now. Mm-hmm. Like, how did I, it's just good hygiene.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, thinking through those pieces. In a quick shift, and we'll wrap it here. Christian, as you look ahead to 2025, this is the time of year everybody's setting goals and some of those kinds of things. Trends, tech trends that or things you're kind of keeping an eye on as we think about just the coming year?
Yeah. So I know this will probably make people sigh because it's super saturated as a word right now, but sorry. Here it comes. Get ready. Get on the edge of your seats. I think the tool chain and compute stack for AI is going to continue to accelerate in 2025 in pretty meaningful ways. And we're seeing a lot of diversification now in both competition within the LLMs, as well as competition within the hardware that runs AI. And so there's some really cool players in this space now, and we're seeing that ecosystem really grow. So I think that's a trend you're going to continue to see boom. I mean, this thing is just growing at a really exciting rate. So I'm excited to see where that goes. And I think, I'm not saying much about, you know, how much it is or isn't a hype curve, but I think most reasonable interpretations would say that what we're doing right now with LLMs is the closest we've gotten to meaningful definitions of toward general purpose artificial intelligence that we've had since we've kind of started on this whole what started as big data and then turned into machine learning and then turned into data science on top of machine learning and then turned into the kind of IBM Watson story, which then kind of turned into the, well, we need more compute and we need more data. And now we have all of that. And then it was, well, we need the hardware to really crunch it all at scale. And then, you know, now we're getting all of that kind of synergy. You know, this is just going to continue to explode. So, again, if you watch financial markets closely and you see just how much enthusiasm there has been in the NASDAQ this year around semiconductors and AI stocks, that's been really fascinating to watch, especially for companies that a couple of years ago probably weren't on as many people's radar, right? So like Palantir recently joined the S&P 500. And, you know, people see that as an AI play. And I don't think people would have been talking about something as something like Palantir as an AI play, certainly from an investment standpoint, prior to this year. And I think those types of trends are going to continue. You're going to see a lot of the other vendors really start to come to life in this space as we get to some notion of enterprise LLM maturity. And so you're going to see more competition there as well. So both on the software and on the hardware side. The other trend that seems to be really interesting is that, you got to kind of follow the breadcrumbs. So it's like, okay, if AI is the thing booming right now, what are the next sectors that benefit from the AI boom? And there's two areas that I would suggest people focus on. Again, this is not financial advice by any means, but you could use it to think about financial ideas as well. One is data center space, right? So like, where are people going to land their, you know, racks of H200 GPUs that they just bought for some enterprise startup that they're dealing with? So data center space and density for running these workloads is going to continue to be a driver. But then where's the power going to come from for all this, right? AI is power hungry, super, super power hungry. And so I think you're starting to see a lot of discussion and shift towards looking into nuclear a lot more seriously for data center projects. And so I would start to look to having maybe another evolution and iteration on new sources, not new, right? Nuclear's been around, but, you know, applying those energy sources in more new and intentional ways to spaces that are going to be incredibly power hungry, because I think we have a lot of undermet manned right now in being able to power the sum total of hardware that's going to be online to deal with this hardware. And, you know, if you look at like the new Blackwell hardware that NVIDIA is, you know, going to be selling next year. Of course, one of investors' concerns around that was the heat and the thermal aspects of Blackwell, right? So, you know, even though they're addressing and working on those things, they're power hungry. You're going to have a lot of heat. So that, you know, a lot of draw. So, you know, really understanding how we're going to iterate and improve energy technologies is going to be super important to sustaining the growth of the AI boom that I think 2024 really represented.
Do you think at some point we outstrip the ability, you know, to actually power what's needed for some? I mean, it grows faster than our ability to provide that power in a cost-effective and responsible way.
It's totally possible. I mean, you're actually, it's interesting. You're seeing some renewed interest in people building supercomputers again too. And obviously, cause that's, you know, now they have something to refocus it on. And, you know, we've always talked from like a retail / average guy perspective, how, you know, you can build these state-of-the-art retail machines and then be like, wow, I got this great, you know, AMD Ryzen with 16 cores and they all go 5 gigahertz. And I got this DDR5 memory and it's blazing fast. And I got this PCIe 5 NVMe, and I got, you know, the latest NVIDIA card in. And then you're like, oh crap, what do I do with this thing? Like,
yeah,
I don't have software that can, you know, take advantage of all of this hardware. So from a retail perspective, we were always like, when is the software going to catch up to what the hardware can do for it now? But certainly on the enterprise side, we're there where, you know, AI is really driving the next generation of hardware demand. So I do very much think that it is possible we don't have the sum total infrastructure capacity that's needed today to support all the potential hardware and use cases that are floating around out there. And yeah, I mean, that's not even counting the crypto world, right? I mean, there's been plenty of studies of how much power it takes to run the blockchain. And so you have boom in crypto, you have the boom in AI. So hardware and how much compute density at what energy sources and factors you can get that operating at scale in is going to be, I think, a huge topic, not just in 2025, but probably you're going to see this be a theme over the next 2 to 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, and both crypto and AI are still fairly gimmicky. I mean, yes, there's some applications in some places very specific that are doing some things, but if you still think about the general consumer, most people don't understand what the value of crypto or what it does. And I think in AI and the stuff, it's a parlor trick, right, for most people. Oh, I put a document in there, it can sum it up for me. Or I, you know, I do some things. I ran a report the other day where I gave it a spreadsheet and I said, you know, and analyze the trends here and tell me if there's been an increase in the number of the test scores over the last, I think I gave it 2 years worth of data. And it worked pretty well for that. It's still a little bit, I mean, listen, I used to be able to write that in SQL. So it's not like it's just writing the SQL for me, right? That's the magic in some cases, is it's taking the query language that I'm putting in English and it's translating it to, because it shows me the query language that it's writing for me and then runs that. Still, I think though, for a lot of people, still fairly gimmicky. What happens when it does go mainstream? Like, what happens if Bitcoin actually takes a foothold in the economy and becomes something real?
Yeah, you mean, we're about to find out at a theater near us in a couple of weeks here. If you follow Bitcoin, the big milestone as of recording this week was the break of the 100,000 price level. We got up to around 104,000, I think, before we pulled back. I don't think you would see the magical 100K stratosphere be breached had, you know, the incoming administration not have a big focus around wanting to make crypto a part of their policy agenda. And really, I mean, you remember maybe 2 years, 3 years ago, I think I did it. I don't remember if it was a Cyber Frontiers or Home Gadget Geeks, but I talked about what was going on with the Federal Reserve and the Treasury wanting to create a government-backed digital currency and CBDCs and kind of what some of the pros and cons were. And quite frankly, all that's out the window now as of this policy. So that is, you know, going to experience a painful death if it hasn't already. And it's clear that Bitcoin and altcoins are going to really have a mainstream policy hold for the first time. So I think we're about to find out, do we have kind of all of the compute infrastructure we need to run that at scale? And I think we do, to be fair, on the crypto side. I think the mining stuff is going to settle down and continue to become less profitable. So I think we're okay on the crypto side. I'm less certain that we can reason about whether or not we have the sum total of capacity on the AI side. I think we're just way too early to know the answer to that question, but certainly going to be a challenge that people are going to be working on. So,
well, both a dollars and cents a problem in the sense that, you know, listen, if crypto didn't make financial sense, it would have gone away a long time ago,
right?
From an economy standpoint, right? But it does. It's working for whatever reason, even though it doesn't have anything. It's not really still doing anything for the most part. It has this perceived value, but this future value and whatever it is. And eventually, you know, the many will become the few and we'll consolidate down to a few. The AI piece is the really scary one because that's got some, not scary in a, not in a bad way, although maybe in a bad way, but when the real practical applications really go mainstream on that and we really find ways to make it very valuable from a efficiencies standpoint, that's when it starts going. I mean, I think we're kind of on the edge of that becoming a reality in a lot of ways. There's some really good, interesting things being done with it that takes away. One of the things I've been hearing in the space about that, and I forget who this was, but they, you know, this dream that, you know, we need to create. Oh, it was one of the, not Elon, but the other guy on this efficiencies committee. I think it was
Vivek.
Yeah, I think it was him. Could be somebody else who said, you know, we need to free ourselves up from the manual things so we can do those things that we're made to do. That model doesn't work. People need to work. Like, if something was going to take my job, that who's going to give me, where's the money going to come from for me to do the things that I'm really, that I really desire to do? We still are going to need to find ways for humans. I think we thought in the 50s, we'd all be sitting around, you know, eating grapes. Well, where do those grapes come from, friends? And how do we decide who gets what in that, right? This idea of a utopia where we just get to sit around and work on interesting projects. That's not an economy that actually works. You know, you don't, yep. who, anyways, it's just such a crazy, that's such a crazy thought. It's like, no, we still need to be productive. People still need to be paid to do things. That's the way economies work. So it'll be interesting to see where, see how this goes. But much like a calculator changed the way we looked at math and sped up the way we do things, you know, the invention of the calculator has driven us to a whole nother dimension. I think AI in a lot of ways, from especially from a language standpoint, we can push some things and make us better and more efficient. But we still got to do things in those. I don't know what they are. I help maybe help each other. Maybe that's what we need to we need to do. I don't know. I don't know how any of that stuff works, Christian, but we'll get there as well. Some good thoughts. Christian, always great to catch up with you. Thanks for spending some time with us tonight. Thanks for saying yes to the podcast 14 years ago. And
it's been a pleasure. Wow. Pleasure. privilege. Pleasure. See?
Yeah.
That's what happens. But it's been awesome. Yeah.
That's what AI is doing to you. It's just making you...
the LLMs are corrupting my mind at this hour.
Your brain is turning to jelly. Well, I don't know if we'll be here 14 years from now, but we will be here for the next 4 weeks anyways, on the live show. And if you're part of the regular podcast listener, Dave McCabe is back. Speaking of 14 years, yeah. Dave McCabe is back next week, catching up with him a little bit. He's got some things he wants to bring in. John Biggs, who's in the chat, John's going to join me, catch us up on some of the tech, some of the fitness tech and such that he's been using. We'll catch up with him. There's this little thing called Christmas coming up. So hopefully you're ready to go. And so that we'll be taking that, that's the 26th, and I'll be taking that night off. And then on the 2nd of January, Erin Lawrence joins us, and we'll talk about some gadgets for the new year and what she's keeping her eye on at CES. And so I don't have 14 years planned, but I do have 4 weeks planned. So come out and join us live Thursday nights, 8 p.m. Central, 9 Eastern, out here at theaverageguy.tv/live. If you want to join the Discord group, which Christian is a part of, by the way.
I'm out there.
The Last Jedi. Right, you're are you the Last Jedi? Is that it? Is it you?
I don't know. I left that handle for people to derive at their own interpretations. But I can tell you that Discord is probably like one of my favorite platforms. So if you tag me in a message, I'm in a lot of different Discords, by the way. So I read through different stuff. So if you don't tag me, I probably don't see your message. But if you tag me, I'm pretty responsive. So if emails are like, you know, sad things, then yeah, just tag me in Discord or Christian@theaverageguy.tv. You can still get me, and happy to chat.
Leave that message if you got advice, if you got dad jokes for Christian, we'll still take some of those. Maybe we'll
Brian set a pretty high bar, by the way. So
what we'll do, we'll throw them in the Discord group. So if I get some of them, you send them to me, or you could post those dad jokes and tag Christian, tag me while you're doing it in the Discord group. We'd love to hear those as well. You can get those in there. Or you can leave them at homegadgetgeeks.com. That's a 30-second voicemail. Although Brian did that and they were blank. I need to check into that. So let's get that done in some way. And then I have to say it. The AverageGuy.tv platform, both web and media hosting, powered by Maple Grove Partners. Get secure, reliable, high-speed hosting from people that you know and you trust. Plans start as little as $10 a month. Chris can do a bunch of things for you. Visit maplegrovepartners.com today if you want to get more information. And you know, it's Christian. You know him now. He's right next to me over here. And so get that done today. We are live every Thursday, 8 p.m. Central, 9 Eastern. Love to have you part of the live show. We'll hang around, not for very much of a post show, but for those of you listening live, stay around for a little bit. John, maybe we'll do the self-congratulatory backslapping, which there's a story behind that. I'll mention that here in just a second. Maybe we'll do that in the post show. With that, we'll say goodbye, everybody.
Good night.